Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of the Two Footer Tackle Podcast. I'm your host, Iris Matakos. We are back again for another week. It is a glorious Monday afternoon at the time of recording. So I can't wait to get this recording done and go and sit outside in the very hot sun and enjoy what is what we're turning to the really hot part of the year, especially in Australia. Tomorrow, public holiday for the horse racing, and it's going to be 30 degrees. So that's a good early start to the summer. Nice, quiet, 30 degree day in the start of November. Can't ask much more. But yes, it's currently very hot in this studio. Very the air conditioning is not functioning to its optimum. So I'm a little bit sweaty, but we power through. I hope everyone is well, as always. But hope everyone has enjoyed their week. I finished uni for the year, final assignment submitted last night, which is grouse. So now I was going to say I can relax, but I can't because I've got this and work and other stuff. But it's good to get one less thing off my plate while we get into summer and then I could properly enjoy it. But yeah, that's good. My football teams on the weekend, well, one of them still hasn't played and we'll speak on Chelsea and we'll do a little bit of a preview for the Chelsea-Spurs game. Not too much because the result's going to happen before this comes out. So I don't want to speak about too much because it's going to be horrendously out of date as soon as the game happens. But regardless, victory won. Oh, no, we didn't. We drew. But it felt like, I wouldn't say felt like a win. Considering 10 men last, what, 10 men with, what, 30 minutes to play. Adelaide have an abundance of attacking talent. So being able to hold them for the last 30 minutes with 10 men, I thought was actually pretty good. So full-time whistle goes, you're like, okay, yeah, we got a point out of a game in which we probably should have won, but we also could have lost quite easily. So I guess it is one of those things. But I'll touch on that a little bit more in-depthly a little bit later on. But yes, I hope everyone is well, as always. I hope, yeah, anything else to catch on? Obviously, haircut, nice trimmed, fade. Look, I've had better ones. I've had better fades. But you know what? You can't win everything. In life, you can't always win. So you take every day as it comes, and you take everything that happens to you as either a success or a lesson. And we've definitely learned a lesson based on this haircut, and that is be far more diligent with who you decide to get your haircut, or where you decide to get your haircut, and whom you decide to get it cut by. Regardless, let's keep going because I'm digressing as per usual. Before we start, I implore you all to subscribe to Two Footer Tackle Podcast on YouTube. Follow on all the socials, Two Footer Tackle Podcast on TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter. There is a link in the bio of both Instagram and Twitter. Yeah, for your Two Footer Tackle podcasting needs, which is always terrific. Furthermore, we will be, what else do I need to plug? The audio platforms, of course. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Anchor, and Spotify for if you want to listen to it on your commute to work, coming home from uni, from work, going to football training, but it's the middle of November, so you're probably not doing football training if you live in Australia. It's cricket training. Or if you just want to listen to it as you go to bed, whatever, just as long as you listen. That's all that matters. And like always, if you do watch on YouTube, just go on over to the audios, give it a follow, a 5-star. Just click play and let it run for 45 minutes while you're eating dinner or something, whatever. Yes, let's crack things on. Or let's crack on with things, I should say. Quite a lot to speak about. A lot of A-League and Australian football chat, so that might be the majority of the podcast, the bigger portion of it, which is always good. Love speaking about football down under. But, of course, some other Premier League happenings. Premier League things definitely did happen, and they caused a mighty stir. So we'll touch on that for sure. We're going to be touching on what happened with Arteta and that whole debacle. The Ballon d'Or happened, so we'll briefly touch on that. That happened on the Wednesday after I recorded and after this podcast came out, so a little bit annoying. We won't touch on it too briefly because it's old news now, but I feel like I'm obliged as a football podcast to speak on the most prestigious award in football. Speak on Chelsea versus Spurs very briefly before we move back down under. Speak about what happened on Saturday night in the original derby. Friday night as well, a couple of things that we should touch on coming out of that game, as well as some other brief tidbits coming from around the league. And then the Tillies, of course, played their final qualification game for this section on last Wednesday. So we'll touch on that ever so slightly. But yes, let's kick things off. I just want to I just want to caveat this. The hay fever, obviously being November, still quite strong. The nose hasn't really, and the sinuses are still kind of battling, being allergic to grass. So I think that just shows how much of a pissant I am. So yeah, I apologize if I stop at any stage. If there's a pause, you can tell I'm about to have an allergic reaction to grass, which is just the most... Yeah, it's awesome, isn't it? Okay, let's kick things off. Let's kick things off, shall we? With the biggest story of the weekend, I should say. Probably in terms of Premier League football, and that was the situation surrounding Mikel Arteta and the goal that was given that some potentially say shouldn't have been given for Newcastle against Arsenal in Newcastle's 1-0 win over Arsenal on it was Sunday morning Australian time. 1-0 win, Anthony Gordon with the goal on the 64th minute or whatever it was. Ball gets whipped in to the back, or to the kind of back post. Yeah, back post. Ramsdale comes to claim, doesn't get there. Joel Linton creates a little bit of a goal mouth scramble, and Anthony Gordon is there to just absolutely hoof the ball into the back of the net. Yeah. Now, where do we go from here? There was a lot of conjecture around that decision. I think there were three bits in that goal which were heavily scrutinized and were put under the microscope. So let's go through them one by one, and then we'll touch on Arteta's reaction. So for those who haven't seen it, I'm sure you would have seen it if you listen to this podcast. If not, just go and search it out. It's really not hard. If I could show the goal, I would. But anyways, so the cross, who delivered the cross? Because obviously Joel Linton got on the end of it. So he was... Who was it? It was Jacob Murphy. So Jacob Murphy gets the ball into the channel, whacks it across goal, and it's gone out. Like, it's whacked across goal, and it goes across the face of goal, running alongside the byline, right? So it's running along the byline as it's going towards the quarter flag. Can I find this game? That'd be great. Okay, here we go. Yeah. As it's running towards the corner flag. Now, who meets it? Who meets it there? It is Willock. So Joe Willock, ironic, considering he's a former Arsenal player. So Joe Willock meets Jacob Murphy's shot that comes across the face of goal, and he meets it as it's going out of play. Now, Joe Willock keeps the ball in play, as it was decided, crosses the ball in, Joel Linton rises at the back post. I think it would have been over Gabriel Magalhaes, maybe? I can't remember. We'll just call it Gabriel. Rises over Gabriel. Goal mouth scramble occurs. Anthony Gordon's there to just whack it in. Okay. The point of conjecture. Was the ball out of play? Now, look, I don't think it was. I think perception is a very important part in... plays a very important part in football. And a perception plays a very important part in VAR decisions especially, right? You look at it from one angle, and it's out of play. You look at it from another angle, and it's not. I think when you look at it from... you need to try and look at it from the most conclusive angle possible, and that is a bird's eye view, right? That is a bird's eye view, as much as possible a bird's eye view, or at least one that is directly on the line. You need to be completely parallel with it, if that makes sense. So I think what you need to look at it, where you need to look at this decision from is there's a TV broadcast and there's the correct broadcast. How many times on TV have we looked at decisions and been like, how is that offside? How that hasn't crossed the line, or he didn't handball that, whatever. And then you look at it from a different angle and it's like, yeah, okay, it did cross the line. He was offside. It was a handball, whatever, blah, blah, blah. It's quite clearly still in play. Like, it's quite clearly still in play, because even from the angle which it shows that it's not, that's just perception. That is just depth of field. Like, the ball, like, even in this shot right now, you guys don't know how far away I am to the background. You don't know whether or not it's 10 meters away. You don't know whether or not I can touch it. You don't know whether it is because of the zoom, because of the positioning. It's the same thing. You don't know where the ball actually is because of the angle, of how zoomed in the camera is, of the shadows of the light, of how big the ball is, how small the line is. You just don't know. What you do know is the conclusive evidence that shows the bird's eye view, which shows exactly where the ball is in relation to the line, conclusively. So I think it's cut and dry. It should be cut and dry anyway. The ball is still in play. So I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem from that aspect anyway. So Willock gets the ball, crosses it in. There's a goal. So Joel Linson rises at the back post. The ball goes over Ramsdale's head. And Joel Linson, does he foul the defender? I don't think he does. Sorry, it was actually David Raya in goal. My mistake. I don't think Joel Linson fouled the defender. I think that's completely fair. It's fair play. It's just two big boys going up for a header and competing in the air. Was there a little bit of a push? Maybe. Was there a little bit of a shift of weight in midair from both players? Maybe. But I don't think it's enough of an impact to cause major kind of. I don't think the impact is big enough to decipher this one to be a foul. I think it's incredibly unfair to call it a foul. And then obviously the ball ricochets, force Anthony Gordon, he smashes it in. Is Anthony Gordon offside? I just don't know. And I think the linesman decision was onside. He didn't pay offside. And I think it's almost impossible to decipher whether or not he's onside because of how quickly the ball ricochets off Jolinson. You don't actually know where the last touch is. You know whether it's off Jolinson. You know whether or not it's off an Arsenal player. You don't know where it actually is. I think the right decision was made at the end of it, right? And I think the right decision was made at the end of it. You can't give that offside. It's inconclusive evidence. I think overall, from those three stages, there was only one bit of conclusive evidence, and that was the ball still being in play. So I think Arsenal fans can't really sit here and argue about that because it was pretty clear that the ball was still in play, right? So I think overall, eventually the right decision was made of it being a goal. Could they have gone about it a different way? Could the referee have gone about it a different way? I think yes, but I think that also goes back to how VAR is operated in England. I don't think it's that specific case issue. I think it's a wider discussion about VAR generally in English football. So I don't think you can sit here and blame like Stuart Atwell? Who was the referee? I don't think you can sit here and blame Stuart Atwell or any one of the fourth officials or anyone in the VAR booth because I think they did their job correctly. I just think the job that they did correctly is the wrong job, if that makes sense. Like, it should have been far more transparent. But we're going to sit here and going around in circles. Remember a couple of episodes ago, a month ago with the Tottenham-Liverpool thing, how I wrote down the 13th of November on a piece of paper? It's not going to show up because of the focus, but I've still got the paper. It still says the 13th of November. If it's not going to focus. I can promise you, here we go. Anyways, I can promise you, it definitely says the 13th of November. We are 1 week off that. So I was one week off the fact that we are still speaking about VAR in the way that we were speaking about it. Quite ironically enough, though, it's actually in the complete opposite reason. I think VAR was correct in this decision, in this circumstance, in this situation, whereas in the Liverpool Tottenham one, quite clear they were incorrect. So there's that. Let's move on to Arteta. Okay, so Arteta came out post game and completely lambasted the officials. Like, it was one of the more ruthless dissections and one of the more laser focused. I wouldn't say character assassinations of the officials, but it was ruthless, like ruthless. He did not hold back in the slightest and was going for their necks. Said it's a disgrace, it can't stand, all this, etc., etc. Now, there's a couple of avenues you can look down this, right? Firstly, as an Arsenal fan, that's exactly what you want to hear from your coach. You feel like you've been robbed and you feel like the referees have wronged you. You want your coach, you want your manager to sit in the interview and defend your club because that cost them 3 points in Arteta's eyes. That decision cost them 3 points. And in a lot of Arsenal fans' eyes, that would have cost them 3 points as well. So Arteta is in his right from an Arsenal perspective to criticize the officials. However, there are two issues that I have with this. Firstly, you need to, as much as players need to be protected, I also think officials do need to be protected because I think officials need to be protected because, I mean, we're going to be speaking about another issue that happened with officiating in the A-League, right? And we're going to be speaking about that a little bit more in depth because of the circumstance around it. But I think officials need to be protected to a certain extent. Arteta going out and completely attacking and borderline abusing the officials is wrong. From a moral and from a objective perspective, it's wrong. From an Arsenal fan perspective, I'd love it. And from the perspective of, there's already a referees crisis all around the world, right? When it comes to football, we need to be able to allow these referees some level of protection when they with their job, right? And I think Arteta is doing, it could set a very dangerous precedent. So there's that. Secondly, I don't know, cast your minds back to the Liverpool Tottenham decision. Mikel Arteta was asked about it and he said, officials make mistakes, it is what it is, you have to learn from it, you just have to go with it. You just have to go with the flow. Officials make mistakes, it is what it is, you have to move on. So for him to say that in that interview and for him to come out in this interview a matter of a month later and lambast the officials to a horrendous extent just because it happened against his team, I think that completely null and voids his argument and his opinion because it's quite clear that he's only saying this because it happened against his team. Because a worse decision was made against another team, he was asked about it and didn't go anywhere near as hard. If he was true to his word and if he was true to wanting this issue being fixed, he would have gone equally as hard at both of these occasions, but he didn't. And I think that goes to show Arteta can sit here and say whatever he wants in the media. He can sit here and say whatever he wants when it comes to... He can sit here and say whatever he wants when it comes to officiating about how officials need to be better and reform we need to have with VAR, blah, 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 blah. But he's shown that he only cares for his team. His best interests aren't for the game of football, are for Arsenal Football Club. So I think that has worked in a negative for him because the Premier League are going to sit back and say, okay, you think X, Y, Z about this decision. We had a decision that was even worse a month ago and you didn't say anything. Or you actually, sorry, in even worse, you did say something, but you were very, very committal and partial and neutral to it. You weren't as aggressive, in a way, for that incident as you were this incident, even though that incident was worse. If Arteta was vehemently against the standard refereeing in England and was vehemently against VAR, he would have come out and been equally as hard on both occasions. But he wasn't. So I think it's a kind of, okay, you don't really care. And I think every manager now that is asked about this decision, that was asked about the decision that happened at White Hart Lane a month ago, they need to sit here and say, okay, were they that hard for that decision as they were for their decision against their team? If they were, then fair play. If they weren't, then it's whatever. Because you can't really sit here and say, okay, how's that fair, if that makes sense. So I think Arteta needs to... I think from an Arsenal perspective, like I said, from an Arsenal perspective, it's great. Good on you. You need to do that, right? But from a football perspective, not good. Not good for the two reasons that I said. You need to protect referees and you also need to be consistent in your opinion. And if you're not, then your opinion's null and void. So doing this has almost acted in a counterproductive way. Because if he had sat here and said, look, a similar incident happened at White Hart Lane, referees make mistakes, you just have to accept it. I can sit here and rant and rave, but nothing's going to change. You just have to accept it. Then I think a lot of people would be like, okay, fair enough, he's been consistent. But he hasn't been. So I think it's very much a yin and yang type thing, or a Jekyll and Hyde type thing, where on one side it's great, and on the other side it's bad, and they kind of act in a counterproductive way to each other, if that makes sense. So yeah, that's all I want to say on Arteta, because I thought Newcastle probably didn't. Did Newcastle deserve the game? Probably not. I mean, when you look at the stats, you can probably almost say that they didn't. They had, 14 shots to 9 Arsenal. They had basically double the amount of passes, 60% possession, give or take. So Arsenal, for an away performance, I think played quite well. Obviously, with no Jesus, with no Jesus, I think they held more than held their own. So I think good result for Newcastle. Arsenal can still take a little bit of solace out of that performance, I think. So yeah, let's move on and let's go to briefly want to speak on the Ballon d'Or and the women's Ballon d'Or as well. Messi and Bonmati. I'm gonna assume that's how you pronounce her name. Aitana Bonmati plays for Barcelona. She was exceptional in the World Cup. For Spain, she won the women's Ballon d'Or. Messi won the men's Ballon d'Or. I'm not gonna sit here and pretend I know a lot about Botmani's year. I know she was good in the World Cup. That's kind of all I really know. So I'm not gonna sit here and say, yeah, she was great for Barcelona. Had 15 goal contributions in 7 games or whatever fucking bullshit. By all accounts, a well-deserving winner. So I'm glad that it was voted very truly like a meritocracy. Congratulations to her. Obviously, Spain have had an illustrious kind of history when it comes to Ballon d'Or winners and being at the top of the women's game. So I mean, that's good for them, and I hope it continues. Unfortunately, Sam Kerr, her second podium finish in a row. Or third. Did she finish? Obviously, 2020, there wasn't one. Anyway, she finished third last year. Finished second this year. Maybe she can go one better next year. If Australia had beaten England, if Australia had won the World Cup, you probably do give it to her. But, yeah, she's banging them in for Chelsea. Didn't actually start on the weekend, so they eased her back in after that international break. Started on the bench. But, yeah, she's obviously a fantastic talent. I can sit here and rant and rave about Sam Kerr for ages, but, We're on the clock. We've got some other things to speak about. So yeah, congratulations to Botmani. Kerr was great as well. And third place was I should really know this, shouldn't I? I want to say Mary Earps, maybe, or was that, or am I misconstruing another year? Am I misconstruing another year? So let's quickly look. Winners. It was. Yeah, no, it wasn't. I'm discarding that. So yes, ignore that I said barriers. It wasn't. I think she was another year. But yes, I digress. Congratulations to all involved. Let's speak on Messi, shall we? Now, I think I said this when I did my World Cup. I'm going to speak about this briefly only. I think I said this when I spoke about it in my World Cup kind of series that I did over the tournament. That final was whoever wins that final wins the Ballon d'Or. That's what I thought it was. Like, Messi wins it, he's got it comfortably, as long as he doesn't absolutely stink up the joint for what was PSG, now into Miami. So there's that. If Mbappe had won the World Cup, he would have won it by a landslide, because there was no way he was going to drop below a more than reasonable performance for PSG. So a lot was riding on that World Cup final. Messi won it, and I think overall it's his eighth Ballon d'Or. You can sit here and say, you can sit here and talk about the validity of the Ballon d'Or. I personally still think it's a very, very prestigious award, and arguably their most prestigious award. And I'll tell you why it's still the most prestigious award is because there's no clear number two. Like, if I was to ask you what is the most prestigious award outside of the Ballon d'Or, I don't think people would give me a clear consensus. So for that reason, I still think you need to treat the Ballon d'Or as seriously as what it's. As how it's treated by the media and how the ceremony treats it, etc. So it's what his eighth Ballon d'Or or something, World Cup winner. It's undisputed now. He's the best ever, and I think this year has really kind of encapsulated just how good Messi has been for however long he's been doing it. Like, it's insane. From the mid-2000s to arguably the mid-2020s, he's just been this stupidly good footballer, like their best we've ever seen. And I think he spoke about it in his speech. He's been so good for so long, he's won so many trophies, he's won so many accolades, but there's always been that missing piece. And now he's finally got that missing piece of being the World Cup. He's now complete. Him as a footballer, his career is complete. So I think you have to give full credit to him, and I thought his speech was very good. From what I saw of it, I can't speak Spanish, but I think he did do a speech in Spanish, didn't he? Unless I'm misremembering that. But from what I saw in the translations and the transcripts and stuff, and from what I watched, he presented himself very good. So there's that. Congratulations, Messi. I was going to speak on the Tottenham Chelsea game, but I'm just going to give a plea. I genuinely, and this is going to go out after the game finishes, so it's going to be quite ironic regardless. I genuinely think Chelsea can win, and I'll give a reason. Chelsea play better against sides that are open, against sides that leave space. I think Chelsea are very good at exploiting space, especially when space is given to players. Chelsea struggle against low blocks. Spurs are obviously going to come out and attack. It's at White Hart Lane, so they're going to come out full throttle, attack, go for it, be high possession, be high tempo. Chelsea can turn the ball over in midfield, get quick, intricate plays up to their forwards on the counter attack. I think Chelsea can definitely win this game, definitely. If I was to give a prediction, gun to my head, I'd still say 2-1 Spurs. But I still think Chelsea can definitely win the game. I can guarantee you Chelsea will score. Chelsea will definitely score. I can tell you that for free. Whether or not it leads to 3 points, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But yeah, please win Chelsea. Please win Chelsea. Anyways, let's move on. And let's move on. And let's touch on some Australian football. Do I go in chronological order? Or do I go in the order that I've got on the run sheet? Yeah, okay, I'm going to touch on the topics I want to touch on first, and then we'll touch on the kind of other stuff towards the end. Let's touch on Irukunda. Let's speak on Irukunda. Irukunda has been the talk of the town of Australian football this weekend again, but this time not for his performance. I guess maybe for his performance, but not because of how good his performance was. So it was Melbourne Victory versus Adelaide United of the weekend. The game ended 1-1. Victory dominated for the most part, and subsequently Irukunda couldn't really get a foothold into the game. It was his third start in a row. It was probably his worst performance of the year. Couldn't really get a foothold into the game. He was started on that right-hand side. Adama Traore went down with an injury. Stefan Nigro got brought on, and Irukunda was very good. Nigro was very good. Was able to negate Irukunda very well. Irukunda switched to the other side, moved over to Connor Chapman's side, and Connor Chapman similarly was able to negate Irukunda quite well. Irukunda got a yellow. I can't remember what for, but I know he definitely got a yellow halfway through the second half, much to the raptures of the Victory supporters, because in the eyes of many Victory supporters, he got Roddy Miranda sent off. Well, not really. Miranda got himself sent off, but regardless. So the crowd started booing Irukunda, started trying to get into his head. Some physical intimidation from some Victory players occurred post that, and then it all came to a head in the 95th minute or whatever it was. Irukunda was manhandled by Konomidis, no foul given. He mouths off at the ref, second yellow card, and he's given his marching orders. And breathe. Where do we go from here? Okay, let's analyze a couple of different things. Okay, let's sit here. First and foremost, Irukunda should have gotten a foul. For that last play on Economides, Economides was dragging his shirt all over the joint. A definite foul, right? So Irukunda rightly has the means to be pissed off with that decision because it was definitely a foul. Okay. Should Irukunda have... Okay, there's that. Victory fans, were they in the right to boo Irukunda? Now, this is something that I've seen a lot on Twitter, especially. I don't understand some people's reaction to Victory fans booing Irukunda. Like, have you not watched football before? Like, an incredibly talented footballer, Nessa Irukunda, has the ability to turn the game on its head and to score a brace and to completely rip Victory a new one, right? Because he's that good. Has a underwhelming performance and a slightly petulant performance. He kicked out a couple of times. He gave up on a couple of chases. He was slightly petulant, right? And Victory fans understood that they were getting in his head a little bit. They were intimidating him a little bit, which meant his performance dropped, which meant Victory had a better chance of winning, naturally, right? It's not the first time opposition fans have booed or have jeered or have sarcastically cheered petulant or poor performances from a star player, right? I remember Victory doing it to Ninkovic at one Big Blue. I remember Victory doing it to Tim Cahill at Melbourne Derbies. I remember Victory fans have done it so many times before, and opposition fans have done it to Victory players before as well. So it's not something completely out of the ordinary. Irukunda is 17 years old. I get that. But once again, he's a professional footballer. Like, we can sit here and we can sit here and sympathize. I do sympathize with Hirakunda. I definitely sympathize with Hirakunda because it's obviously an incredibly tough position to be in for someone at such a young age. So I sympathize with him and I sympathize with everything. It kind of boiled to a point where it just exploded. So I do sympathize with him. However, I don't sit here and subscribe to the theory that Victory fans were out of line for booing a 17-year-old because regardless of the fact that he's 17, he's still a professional footballer. He's still a professional footballer that is extremely talented. So Victory fans are within their right to try and put off and intimidate the opponent. It creates a hostile atmosphere. It creates this... It's why a home ground advantage is a thing. If Victory fans sat here and rolled out the red carpet for Hirakunda, started applauding him as he was coming onto the field, and he goes and scores a brace, we're sitting here and going, well, of course, we allowed him to do this, right? So I don't subscribe to the theory that Victory fans shouldn't have booed Hirakunda. Similarly, I don't subscribe to the theory that Victory players, in particular Connor Chapman, should have gone easier on Hirakunda within the realms of the game. I think he's a professional footballer, 17 years old or not, he's a professional footballer. You cross that white line, your objective is to win. And as a footballer, you do everything in your power to win. So there's that. They're the two things. Should Connor Chapman have given Hirakunda his marching orders after he got sent off? Probably not. That is probably one thing where I reckon Connor Chapman probably will sit back and think, probably shouldn't have done that. And the reason being is that as soon as Hirakunda sent off, he's not playing football anymore. Like, he's not a football... Like, right then and there, he's not a professional footballer playing professional football because he's just been sent off. So right now, he returns to being a person, right? And more importantly, this is where the age factor, in my opinion, comes into play. Because he's 17 years old, right? He's still a child. He's still a kid, right? He's younger than me, for God's sake. So I think once he gets sent off, you don't sit there and give him his marching orders. You just let him go off. You let him do what he needs to do and walk off the field. So there's that. Should Hirakunda have reacted in the way that he did to the non-foul? No, he shouldn't have. Is he well within his rights to be aggrieved at the non-decision? Of course, because it was 100% a free kick. But he should not have reacted like that, especially on a yellow card. I think that's all the topics that need to be discussed when it comes to this, because it's a very nuanced kind of situation. I think I don't think Victory fans are necessarily at fault. I don't think Hirakunda is necessarily at fault. I don't think Connor Chapman's necessarily at fault. And I don't think the referee is inherently at fault, although he should have controlled the situation a lot better. The referee and the linesman should have controlled the situation a lot better. I think that is abundantly clear. So I do sympathize with Hirakunda because he's a kid. He just couldn't control his emotions at that stage. He had a poor game. It just got all too much and he kicked off, right? And he spat the dummy a little bit. But he will learn. He will learn he will learn two things. He'll learn how to try and overcome a slightly more aggressive fullback and a slightly more shithousery when it comes from opposition teams, and he'll learn how to overcome those emotions when things aren't going his way and how he should rebound from that in-game as well as when the game ends and etc. So I think it's a very nuanced conversation. I think Hirakunda will come out of this better, and I think he will look at that situation on Saturday night and be like, I should have acted better there. Same with Connor Chapman. Connor Chapman will be like, I was a bit of a dickhead giving him his marching orders after he got sent off. I think a lot of people, I think the referee should definitely sit there and say, okay, I think he probably should have controlled that a little bit better. Yeah, it was just a thing that happened. And overall, no one got hurt. No one got hurt. No one got seriously injured. No one, there was no massive malaise. It's just a bit of drama. It's just a bit of footballing handbags, which happens. And if anything, it drives people to the league because it was enthralling. Like, I knew people who are football fans but aren't necessarily A-League fans. They went to that game, their first game in a long time. They went to that game on Saturday night and they turned to me after that and they said, that was enthralling. That was compelling entertainment. Irukunda had 15,000 people on strings. He had 15,000 people on strings. And he didn't even play that well. Like, the drama of that's insane. So, yeah, that's just my two cents on that whole thing. On that whole situation. Touching on the game, I thought Victory played very well. I thought Victory dominated for the most part. They really should have been, 3-4 up by the time Adelaide got their goal. Fabian Monge, who made his debut, obviously signing, got signed from Appiah Leichhardt, made his debut. I thought he played very well in the centre of midfield. I thought you had a midfield of Ryan Teague, Zidane Machach, and Fabian Monge, who were very good. I thought that midfield three worked very well. I thought Ryan Teague just continued to just do the simple stuff so well. Like, his Ryan Teague's fundamentals are insane. Like, it's just so good. Like, he just does everything, does the basics so well. Zidane Machach, or Fabian Monge, probably should have scored that goal, but apart from that, I thought he held his own quite well. Lacks a little bit in stature, but he's quite good, got good close control. Has the ability to understand game state and momentum and stuff, so he can really change the way he needs to play for the situation of the game, which I thought was quite good. And Zidane Machach, I mean, I'm going to call it right now. Like, he, I don't know if this is bias speaking, but he is well within the shout for the Johnny Warren medal. I know it's 3 game weeks in, but his performance on the weekend was stupid. Like, it was literally men against boys. Men against boys. I mean, he gave the assist for the Fornaroli goal, and he just hip and shouldered that poor defender into the next suburb. And then just after half time, he gets past two defenders at absolute ease and whips in a Rabona cross. If someone was on the end of that cross, I think I literally would have spontaneously combusted. Like, the noise that came out of my mouth when he whips in that Rabona cross was like, I nearly, like, it was an out of body experience. He is freakish. Like, he is so good, and if he can just stay fit and keep doing what he's doing, there's no reason why he can't really put the cat amongst the pigeons for the Johnny Warren medal and really take Victory quite far in this league. But I thought Victory were quite good. Adelaide are okay. They'll be okay. It was one of those games where Victory just had a lot of it, and Adelaide defensively were very good. Joe Gauci was great. He was awesome. I thought off the bench, I mean, at one stage, I had a front three of Bernardo, Musa Toure, and Irukunda, who were, like I said, have a combined age of 14. So, like, they're still quite good. I thought Johnny Yule was great as well. He's another fantastic talent. So, yeah. Adelaide will be okay. Victory will probably be better on the day, but one of those things, isn't it? Moving on to other interesting things. Let's speak on Sydney briefly. Sydney have not scored a goal yet this season, have not won a game yet this season, coming off the back of a Australia Cup victory, lifting the Australia Cup for their, what, like, second time, I think it is, maybe third time. It's a really, really interesting dynamic at Sydney, because I don't know how to kind of analyze them. Are we analyzing them as a team that should be competing for the top four, should be competing for the championship? Are we dissecting them as a team that is, like, in the mid table? Are we analyzing them as a team that is rebuilding? I don't know. I predicted them to finish in the top four. I think I drastically overestimated their squad. I think I drastically overestimated some of the quality of their players. They lost 2-0 on the weekend to a Melbourne City side who had just sacked their coach. The second goal in particular was just horrendous. Like, Ryan Grant, that's one of the worst pieces of defending I've ever seen in my life. Like, it was, like, just bad defending. Bad, horrendous. When you look at their team, nothing really strikes out as... Nothing really strikes out to me as something that we should really be looking at. I mean, you've got Bratton, who's 33. Caceres, who's 31. You've got Lolly, who's 31. You've got a lot of old players, like Mack, who's 32. And then you've got, like, Ryan Grant, who's, what, 32 as well. At Redmayne, who's, what, 40, 34. Like, you've got a lot of old players. And then you've just got, like, Patrick Wood, who's 21. Joel King, who's, what, 22, 23. You've got a bunch of kids, like a bunch of kids sprinkled amongst old players. Like, the gap, like the bridge between the really old and experienced to the young and inexperienced is too big. Is too big in that squad. Like, they brought Gabriel, who's their centre back, who's 24. Even like Garud, who's that? Who's their centre half? The Aussie centre half's 22. Like, there's a lot of inconsistency throughout that squad. You've got Corica, who came in, who's been very loyal to Sydney throughout his both playing. He's been very loyal to Sydney throughout his managerial career. He inherited a squad from Graham Arnold that was one of the better A-League squads we've ever seen. He won a grand final and got to another one, I think it was. Is he the problem? Should he be sacked? I don't know. Like, I don't... It's just really weird and confusing. Like, I saw them win the Australia Cup and I was like, okay, they're going to be good. Will they be exceptional? Probably not. Will they light this league on fire and be the best team this league has ever seen? Probably not, but they'll be good. They'll be okay. They'll be top five, top four. I thought they'd be pretty good. But no goals scored in the first three games. What is it? Was it a 2-0 loss, 3-0 loss, and a 2-0 loss? It's what? That's 2, 4, 8. No, 7. 7 goals conceded. Jesus Christ, quick maths. 7 goals conceded, no goals scored. Their next run of fixtures is what? I've got Adelaide in Adelaide on Saturday night, which could be very ugly. Then they've got the Sydney Derby. Two games which could seal the fate for Steve Corica, because there is a very real possibility. I know Western Sydney haven't set the world on fire, right? Haven't set the world on fire. They're currently, what, fifth with a win and two draws. But if they lose their next two games, he's gone. Has to go. Absolutely has to go. You can't start a year with 5 losses on the bounce. I don't care if you won the Australia Cup. If he loses their next two games, which are very, very realistic possibility, he has to go. It's unsustainable. Completely unsustainable. So it's quite a drastic shift. I didn't think we'd be sitting here speaking about it like this, considering where they were at the start of the year and the signs that they brought in and their Australia Cup victory. But it looks like a shambles. Like, offensively, nothing going for them. Defensively, they look shaky. There's no synergy within the entire squad. Like, I think that goes back to the fact of you have 5 30-plus-year-olds and then you've got 5 teenagers and 21-year-olds. There is no kind of ability to integrate a whole squad together. It feels like you've got 5 old players, 6 young players, and just brought them together. There's no middle ground. There's no connection. There's no link. And it's creating a completely disconnected football club on the field. I don't know what it's like back. I don't know what it's like in the back room. I don't know what the fans are feeling with the board and with the coach. I'm not that clued up. But yeah, I don't know. I think the statement is, if Sydney lose their next two games, Corica is sacked. Has to be. And I think it's going to be a little bit of a wait and see type area for that. But yeah, they lost 2-0 to Melbourne City, who in their own right sacked Rado, which is insane. As I want to finish up quite quickly, but yeah, City sacked Rado in weird circumstances. It was on Wednesday morning, so quite ironically, the night after this podcast goes out. By night after, I mean morning after. I didn't think they were like too bad. Like, they lost to Western United, they lost 6-0 to Adelaide United in their first two games, but I thought they were okay. Like, I didn't think they were, I think the 6-0 over Adelaide was just one of those games. I thought they played okay against Western United. I thought some of their players that they brought in, like I said, Arslan, I thought has been very good for them. He got an assist on the weekend. Saki as well was able to perform. McLaren finally got on the score sheet again this season. So I thought, yeah, I don't know, weird resignation or weird sacking. They brought in Aurelio Vidmar, who is a very experienced, he's definitely an experienced manager in this league, knows the country, knows the players, knows the style of play, has been around the traps, being a system manager, playing, coaching at youth level, I'm sure, and he just knows what he needs to do. So yeah, I think City, I didn't think they'd sack him, but I think now that they have, they'll be okay. I think Vidmar will just have them playing normal football. I can see them definitely being in the top 6, probably challenging for top 4 at some stages as well. So, yeah, I don't see any any kind of crisis talks for City at this stage. I was surprised they did sack him, but I think it was one of those things where they have, now we need to move on. I thought Rado was quite good, to be honest, for City. I thought Rado was quite good for City. Obviously when Kisnorbo came and gone, obviously the grand final result wasn't ideal, but I thought they were going to be able to rebound off that. I thought they were going to be able to rebound off that quite well. Obviously Rado coaching the he coached the women's team as well, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, coached the women's team as well. So and he did quite well there, if I'm not mistaken. So yeah, I don't know. Interesting, definitely interesting. But I guess we'll just have to wait and see when it comes from that. For City, I think that'll be good. I think that'll still be okay. So yeah, there's all for that. I want to briefly speak on Wellington as they beat Brisbane Roar 5-2. Thrilling kind of performance from Wellington at home. Oscar Zavada is incredible. I think he's a very, very good number 9. He scored a hat-trick. He was great. Bozda Crave. I know his last name's Crave. I don't know how to pronounce his first name, but he scored a brilliant goal on the counter-attack. I think Wellington are going to be a very exciting team this season. They're currently third with 2 wins and a draw. Their draw came against Western Sydney, which was ironically the most boring game of football I've ever watched in round one. So, yeah, I thought he was good. I thought Wellington were quite good. They got, 8,000 or something at Sky Stadium, and I think Wellington are one of many sides that will benefit a lot, that would benefit a lot from like a Cooper Stadium or like a Macedonia Park or something like this. It's just, the stadium's too big, so you can't justify it. You can't justify what 40,000 seat stadium for Wellington. It's, you just can't do that. Even Victory can't justify a 40,000 seat stadium. So yeah, I thought they performed quite well. MacArthur got that 1-0 win quite late on, which is good to see. Perth got a 2-0 win over Central Coast. Central Coast are in a world of hurt. I thought they'd be a little bit better than what they were. I still think their squad is quite good. I mean, when you look at the team that they played on the weekend, like Tulio, Wenzel Halls, Thea Harris, Nisbet, Farrell, Kaltak, Vukovic, Stormaru, like it's a pretty good squad. I just think the turmoil that happened in the off season with Cummings leaving, with Montgomery leaving, just a lot of turmoil, a lot of upheaval, which has just completely disconnected and fractured the squad. I think maybe they can turn around. Maybe it's going to take their coach being sacked. I don't know, but yeah, that's just my 2 cents on Central Coast. Perth look good. I think Stagic, for God's sake, is building quite something quite good. I think Perth are going to be, I predicted them to be in the bottom four, but I think I like their team. Taggart, I like. Joe Colley, I think he's good. A lot to like from this Perth team. And I think they're going to build something quite good. Was this game? I didn't actually catch this game, unfortunately, because I was still out. Was this game at? It was at HBF Park. So they got 6,500. I was going to say because I saw the crowd. So, yeah, good performance from Perth from all accounts, which is good to see. Because they're one of the clubs which you'd like to see do quite well. And then Sunday, Newcastle and Western Sydney drew 2-2, from which, once again, was from all accounts not a bad game. Stamatopoulos, close to my last name, scored a brace. Trent Bahaja got 2 assists. I really like Trent Bahaja as well. I think he's a talent. I think he's a very good footballer. And Western Sydney, got their 2 goals as well, which was great. But yeah, I think that's all for the A-League actions. Anything else I want to speak before we wrap up? The Tillies were great. They won 3-0. Terrific stuff. Mary Fowler is a fucking jet. She's so good. Like, that goal on Wednesday night was insane. Like, that goal is fucked. She just takes the ball, one shot, bang, top bins. Fucking insane. It's so good. She's so good. I can't wait for when they play next. Hopefully they play their game against Uzbekistan in Melbourne, the second leg. That would be more than ideal. But regardless, I'm digressing. Thank you all very much. I'm going to finish wrap things up now as we tick over the 50-minute mark. Thank you all very much for watching another episode of the Two Foot Attacker Podcast. I implore you all to subscribe once again, like, notification bell, do all the good stuff. Make sure you follow the socials, Two Foot Tackle Podcast on TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter. All the audio platforms, Two Foot Tackle Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Anchor. Please win, Chelsea. Please win. I love you, Ange, but for this game, we want Chelsea to win. But yes, thank you very much for watching if you have. Stay well, stay safe. See you guys next week. Come on, Chelsea. Goodbye.